Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox here at CindySheehanSoapbox.com and Rational Radio 1360 AM in Dallas, Texas. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan, and today we're going to interview Noam Chomsky. I have your questions, so stay tuned. When we come back, we'll have Professor Noam Chomsky.
Cindy Sheehan's new ebook, Myth America 2, further examines two distinct classes of people that clearly show that we are not all in this together, as President Obama has declared. The first group, the robber class, are wealthy victimizers such as those corporations and politicians that profit off the hard labor of others through economic theft and violent exploitation. The second group, the robbed class, are the victims such as those who work multiple jobs just to make ends meet, those who tragically send their children off to die in robber class wars, those who lack proper health care, those who are denied decent education, and those who lose jobs and homes due to robber class graft. The robber class controls our government, and as Cindy says, we, the robbed class, can only be robbed if we allow it. With pinpoint accuracy, humor, and in layperson's terms, Cindy Sheehan shows us why we should no longer be codependent with the robber class. To obtain a copy of Myth America 2, please visit CindySheehansSoapbox.com.
Hi, my name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you are listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.CindySheehansSoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.CindySheehansSoapbox.com.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Thank you for staying tuned in. Our guest today is world-renowned Noam Chomsky. I'm very excited to have him on the show, very honored that he's going to be here. Noam Chomsky is an American linguist, a philosopher, a cognitive scientist, a political activist, author, and lecturer. He's an institute professor and professor emeritus of linguistics at MIT. Chomsky is well known in the academic and scientific community as one of the fathers of modern linguistics, but we're not going to talk to him today about linguistics, even though that's very interesting. Since the 60s, he has become known more widely as a political activist, a dissident, an anarchist, and a libertarian socialist intellectual. Beginning with his opposition to the Vietnam War, Chomsky established himself as a prominent critic of U.S. foreign and domestic policy. He is a self-declared adherent of libertarian socialism, which he regards as the proper and natural extension of classical liberalism into the era of advanced industrial society. Noam, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Delighted to be with you.
Oh, we're very honored to have you, and all my listeners are very, very excited about this. I got dozens of questions for you, and I know we don't have time to ask dozens, so I kind of picked the representative sample from my listeners. So let's just get right into it. My first question, or the first question for you, is from Anthony Gumbrell in Seattle, Washington, and he says, how is President Obama different from, and how is he the same as, President Clinton and President Bush?
Well, he's somewhat different because circumstances are different, so they're facing different issues. But I think it's pretty fair to say that Obama's adopts pretty much the same framework of policy making, domestic and international, as Clinton. And so kind of a new Democrat approach, as it's called. And it's not that different from Bush's second term.
Right.
His first term was, kind of abrasive, aggressive, insulting. Actually, U.S. prestige sank to its lowest point in history under the first term, but they retracted considerably during the second term and, in fact, got rid of some of the most offensive characters.
Like Donald Rumsfeld?
Like Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Donald Fife, others, They couldn't get rid of Cheney because he was the administration.
But, right. Well, we see a continuation in that after Donald Rumsfeld was forced to resign or whatever, Robert Gates was appointed, and yeah. Robert Gates is still the Secretary of Defense. So there's a continuity of policy, right?
Yeah, but they're, you know, the policy spectrum is not very wide.
Right.
But there are differences. I mean, let's take Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everyone was, outraged about the Bush doctrine, you know, preventive war and so on and so forth.
Right.
But it was mostly because of the style in which it was presented. And if you take a look at the Clinton doctrine, which was presented quietly and politely and didn't arouse any antagonism, it was actually more extreme than Bush. I mean, his position was that the U.S. has the right to use force unilaterally in order to assure access to and control over markets and resources without even the pretexts that the Bush and the neocons insisted on.
Well, right. And I think that when something that I say about the Obama administration is that it's just a kinder, gentler face that they're putting on these imperial policies to, I don't know, to make them more palatable, but just to not be, as you said, so hostile and so arrogant.
Yeah, I mean, take, say, Europe, like the Peace Prize. I mean, they love Obama, and it's because he treats them nicely. Actually, there was a nice comment made about this in private, it's declassified now, back in the Kennedy days,
mm-hmm.
Which applies very well. Right at the peak of the missile crisis, where the Kennedy planners were making decisions which could have easily led to the destruction of England.
Right.
And they weren't telling the British. The reason is, they said, we know from the internal records have been declassified, they had total contempt for Europeans. They said Europeans aren't as rational and as we are, so we can't let them in on this. They're too emotional. So they weren't telling the British, who were naturally pretty upset. And at one point, a senior advisor, it was probably Acheson, defined the special relationship between Britain and the United States. He said, the special relationship means Britain is our lieutenant. The fashionable word is partner. Now, of course, Britain likes to hear the fashionable word. And
right.
That's basically the difference between Rumsfeld and Gates, or Bush and Obama. The first Bush administration just told them flat out, you're our lieutenant.
Mm-hmm.
When they went to the UN, Powell and others said, you do what we say or you're irrelevant. Okay, they don't like to hear that. They like it the way Obama comes across.
Well, and of course.
You're our partners, and then we'll do whatever we like.
Right, well, of course. And then the Blair regime in Great Britain were partners, and the people of Great Britain, the grassroots, were very disgusted with that. I happened to be in Stockholm, Sweden, when the Nobel Peace Prize was announced. And even though they do like Obama better than Bush, 9 people out of 10 were appalled that Obama was awarded the Peace Prize.
Well, you're talking about people on the streets, I'll bet.
No, yes, of course, people on the streets.
Well, that's quite different.
Not the ruling class.
The elites like to be treated as partners. Now,
right.
Take Blair. I mean, he was treated with contempt. That's why the British called him Bush's poodle.
Exactly. Well, let's go on to the next question. We're talking about Great Britain. This one comes from Great Britain. This question from a listener, I apparently listens on the internet. His name is Richard Simons. And this is a very interesting question, I think. If the president invited you, Professor Chomsky, to be part of an advisory team like President Roosevelt's Brains Trust in 1932, what would you advise the president now to his 3 greatest priorities?
Well, there are so many. First of all, the assumption is inconceivable, but let's put that aside. There are quite an array of serious crises that we have to face. I mean, 2 of them stand out, because they are literally crises of species survival.
Mm-hmm.
One is the environmental crisis, the other is nuclear war. And they're both extremely dangerous, getting more dangerous. And unless something is done about them, the chances of decent human survival are not very high. And then there are other very major crises, some domestic, some international. There's quite a list of them. So take one. Today, it was announced quietly that the great powers, you know, the rich countries, developed countries, are backing off on their promise to do something serious about the international food crisis, which is awful.
Right.
I mean, there's now over 1 billion people who are going hungry. That's increasing fast. Oxfam just reported that 16,000 children are dying every day from hunger-related disease and so on.
Right.
Now, that's, you just think about that. 16,000 children a day is twice the level of Rwanda, not for 100 days, but every day. And we're now deciding to cut back efforts to deal with it. Well, that's a pretty serious crisis. And it's also a moral crisis in the West, namely the fact that the Western powers are cutting back on their efforts to deal with this awful crisis so that they can ensure that Goldman Sachs executives get their bonuses.
Well, let's take the environmental crisis. I told you before we went on the air that I've been invited to go to Oslo when Obama gets his prize to protest with the peace movement there in Scandinavia. But I'm also invited to take a trip to Copenhagen. So with that conference coming up, what would be your advice to President Obama? And he should appoint you to a brains trust, but, you know, we don't think that's going to happen. But what would be your advice?
Well, actually, the advice has to be much broader than to Obama. We have to remember that the president is, without implying that he means anything particularly, he's in any event restricted in what he can do by the existing power systems. But what ought to be done, and it's not just Obama, it's the corporate system, it's the media and everyone else, is recognize very clearly that unless we take strong, decisive action, we're going to destroy the possibility for a decent existence for our grandchildren and everyone else. Now, one of the most shocking news stories, actually reports, it barely got reported, of, I don't know, maybe the decade, just came out a couple of weeks ago. There was a major poll, a reliable poll, which has been monitoring attitudes of Americans on the environment for a long time. And they discovered in the past year there's been a sharp decline in concern about environmental issues. In fact, now barely over a third of Americans believe that human activity has anything to do with global warming. Well, that's like a death sentence for the species.
Right.
And we can trace it very easily. There's been a major corporate media campaign over the past year to try to convince people that it's all, kind of just a lot of scientists talking through their hats. And it's had an effect. I mean, the mainstream media don't agree with it, but they handle it as a kind of a you said, she said story. You know, so on the one hand, there's 99% of scientists, and on the other hand, there's ExxonMobil and Rush Limbaugh, and we got to give them equal time.
Well,
so how are people supposed to decide?
Right. Well, there's the deniers now who, like you said, say that humans have nothing to do with this catastrophic climate change, that it's all cyclical.
Yeah, and that's about two-thirds of Americans, virtually no scientists, and nobody knows anything.
Except for, like you said, the corporatists who are fighting for clean coal.
And that's really quite interesting, because if you were to interview ExxonMobil executives, they would agree with the scientists. They know how serious it is. But in their institutional framework, it's not that they're bad people. You want to be an ExxonMobil executive, you're committed to try to maximize short-term profit and market share. If you don't do that, you're out. So you can be a nice guy and still be working hard to destroy the possibility for your grandchildren to survive.
And that's due to 1886, when corporations were given 14th Amendment protection without any of the responsibilities, yeah. And their only responsibility is to turn a profit for their shareholders.
Well, that's, I mean, it was mentioned in Santa Clara, 1886. It was really instituted strongly early in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
But
right.
And then there were other court cases. But you know, mm-hmm. what it amounts to is, and it's in the modern sense of, in modern corporate law, Anglo-American, but it's not very different elsewhere, corporate executives have a duty, they have a legal responsibility to maximize profit and market share. Anything else is strictly illegal. But the point is, even if it wasn't a law, I mean, if they didn't play that game, they wouldn't be in business. I mean, you know, and we don't have a very, you know, we have a kind of an oligarchic state-based economy, but there's right. some degree of competition. And to the extent that there is competition and market processes, there are built-in inefficiencies, just inherent inefficiencies of markets. And they're very well known, like anyone will study them in first term of economics. What it's called is avoiding externalities. So like if, say, you know, you sell me a car, we'll, if we're clever, make a good deal for ourselves, but we're not considering the effect of that transaction on others. We
right.
don't price that in.
Right.
And there's an effect. You know, there's more pollution, there's more congestion, you know, price of oil goes up and so on. And that can spread widely over an awful lot of people. Now, when a big institution like, say, Goldman Sachs acts that way, as they must in a market system, they ignore what's called systemic risk. Like they may take account of what happens to them if a loan goes bad, but they don't take account of what happens to the whole system.
Right.
That's what we're in right now, in fact. Systemic risk was underpriced, and the whole thing crashed. Now, these are core market inefficiencies. They're inherent. I mean, they can be controlled by extensive regulation, and you know, in my opinion, we can have better systems than markets. But
mm-hmm.
Within the existing, you know, framework of society, markets just have to be regulated
right.
to overcome these inherent inefficiencies. And we're seeing it in the ExxonMobil and, you know, other energy corporation propaganda campaigns to try to block any serious energy legislation.
Mm-hmm.
And to change people's minds, you know, to make them think, look, there's nothing going on. Don't believe these pointy-headed liberal scientists. You get an extreme version of it on talk radio.
Right.
But you get a, you know, kind of a more mainstream version from the energy corporations.
Well, while we're on this subject, did you see Michael Moore's new movie, Capitalism, A Love Story?
No, haven't seen it yet.
Well, this next question goes really well with it.
Okay.
He thinks that capitalism is an evil system, and it doesn't need to, you know, not to regulate it, but to overthrow it and replace it. But what he thinks we need to replace, and this is kind of where I had a problem with the movie, it's a good movie, putting these terms and, you know, and the subject into the mainstream. But what he says is that we need to replace capitalism with democracy. Now, Jim Purdy, and to me, they're two different things, but Jim Purdy from Canada wanted to ask you this question, kind of goes with what we were talking about. He says, is it possible, excuse me, to have a true democracy given the cost of running, I guess that means running for office, and the fact that you only have two parties and the presidency all funded by corporate interests?
Well, that question, as I understand it, is it possible to have a true democracy under corporate capitalism?
I think so.
Yeah, no, for these reasons, for example. In fact, just take a look at the Supreme Court right now. The Supreme Court is considering a case, the Clinton film case, which, to put it in simple terms, amounts to the question, should corporations be permitted to buy elections openly, or should they have to do it indirectly the way they do now?
Right.
But it's true. I mean, financing, you know, there's pretty good, there's good studies of this, which show that camp financing is a pretty good predictor of victory, but more interestingly, financing is a pretty good predictor of policy. Uh-huh. And in fact, you can see it right at this minute. Take Obama. He was put into office primarily by the financial institutions. And that's kind of the core of his funding,
right?
The heavy funding. And they preferred him to McCain. They thought he'd do a better job for them than McCain would. And that's essentially what carried him over in the swing states at the end.
They covered their bases, though, because they did give McCain some money, but not as much as they gave Obama, for
right.
sure.
But what they gave Obama was enough to, you know, put him over, and they're being repaid. I mean, the big banks are euphoric, you know, bigger than before, taking more risks than before, you know, record profits and bonuses, setting the stage for the next financial crisis. And, it's sometimes called irrational exuberance, but that's a mistake. It's perfectly rational exuberance. They should take great risks, make huge profits, and if anything goes wrong, they've got a government insurance policy. Taxpayer bails them out.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So why not take great risks and, right. you know, tank the economy down the road?
Well, and then, of course, Obama has populated his economic team with Goldman Sachs people, with people who were active during the Clinton administration that worked really hard to overturn Glass-Steagall. And so we're getting the blowback from that also, I believe.
Yeah, and he also systematically excluded mildly dissident voices, including Nobel laureates like mm-hmm. Stiglitz and Krugman and others. I mean, anyone who didn't go along with the essentially the Goldman Sachs agenda just wasn't even allowed in as an advisor.
Well, and like you said, mildly different kind of ideologies.
No.
Well, since this is going to go off the script, this is one of my questions. You've described yourself as a libertarian socialist, and I think that this would be a good time to talk about that, right, after this question about corporate capitalism.
Right. Well, I think that may be what that questioner was driving at in maybe different terminology. I mean, libertarian socialism is just, you know, it's often called, I mean, it's the European term for anarchism.
Right.
And it's which they took for granted is going to be socialist and anti-capitalist. And it's the anti-state, anti-hierarchy version of anarchism, of socialism.
Mm-hmm.
So different from Bolshevism, say.
Mm-hmm.
What it calls for is a full democracy. That means workers' control in factories, community control of communities. In fact, every institutional structure should be under direct popular control and popular management. That doesn't mean you appoint a professional manager and go home. It means the population ought to participate in decision-making as much as possible. You can't do it 100% in every structure in which we live. And there ought to be a constant struggle, a never-ending struggle, to identify hierarchical and authoritarian relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And if they can't justify themselves, to dismantle them. And that goes from, you know, the family to international affairs.
And that's, is that more classical liberalism? Because when you think of a libertarian, you think of, in these days, you think of mostly people who are, you know, talk about free market, free market, free market. That's all I hear from the libertarians.
Well, that's a particularly American phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
That's a particular version of right-wing anarchism that did flourish in the United States, but has very little to do with the tradition. And the so-called libertarians in the United States, though, you know, they don't believe it, are in fact calling for tyranny. I mean, if you have the kind of system they're talking about, you will have concentrations of capital
right.
With enormous power.
Right.
And they're the worst kind of tyrannies that there are. They're completely unaccountable.
Well, and I agree that we have to do something with the, you know, our system, our financial system in this country, the central
more than
The central banking. But, you know, when they call for a gold standard, that is elitist also, I believe.
Well, see, I don't think that technical fixes like that matter. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter whether it's gold or, you know, whatever. What matters is who decides. And it's not just the financial system. It's the productive system, the retail system, you know, Walmart, so whoever it may be. I mean, we have a whole variety of kind of institutional structures in which we take part all the time, but we have very little to say about them. They're run by other people. We follow their orders.
Well, and then, of course, we only have the appearance of choice when it comes to federal elections. We don't really have true choice. I call it the Ayatollahs of America who pick our candidates.
Well, we have candidates have to be, they have to pass through the filter of acceptance by concentrated wealth and power. Otherwise, they can't run. There are other methods that are used to block alternatives, like gerrymandering, which is extreme.
Right.
But the main one is that you simply cannot run unless you have massive capital resources. And that means you're enthralled to the people who provide them. Of course, that undermines even formal democracy.
Oh, absolutely. We just have a few more minutes left, and I think the questions that I have are going to take more than just a few minutes to answer, but let's just try this one from Pierre Stan Honigsvog, and he wants to know, what should Obama, or we just say the system, because we've already talked about Obama is just the tip of the iceberg, what should Obama do to pressure the Israelis to engage in real peace negotiations?
That's one of the easiest problems,
mm-hmm.
and they know exactly what to do. I mean, if Israel can, you know, Israel is subordinate to the United States. If the U.S. takes a stand, they just have to agree.
Mm-hmm.
They have no choice. If the United States decided to join the world and accept the international consensus, very broad international consensus, virtually everyone, on a two-state settlement, roughly on the international border, maybe some modifications.
Right.
If the U.S. would go along with that, Israel would go along too. They'd have no choice. But Obama doesn't want to do it. What he's calling for is something very narrow,
uh-huh.
no expansion of settlements, but even which is, you know, a marginal issue. And even on that, he told Netanyahu, just don't take me seriously.
Mm-hmm, right.
In fact, when he said it, in a press conference, his spokesman was asked, are you going to take the actions that President Bush number one took? I mean, he did impose mild sanctions if Israel continued to expand settlements, and it was enough to, you know, make them change, to kick out one president, bring in another. But Obama said, no, we're not going to do that. This is purely symbolic. We're not going to do anything. Okay, that's a way of telling Netanyahu, just go ahead.
Why do you think that relationship exists? Like you said, that Israel is subordinate to the United States. Why do you think the relationship exists that we actually go along with what Israel wants to do and not the other way around?
Well, it's because they are doing pretty much what we want them to do.
Right.
I mean, Israel is a very valuable. You can argue that maybe the planners are making the wrong decision, but they have, you know, for a long time, both in the political system and in the economic system, have regarded Israel as a very as an asset. It's a rich country, thanks in substantial measure to our contributions.
Right.
But it is a rich country. It's developed. It has a highly educated, technical sector. Very high inequality, but has a high level of technology. It's very closely linked to the United States. High-tech investment in Israel is going up constantly. Let's say take Intel, which is, you know, the world's major chip maker. They have announced that they're producing a new generation of chips, which will be the global standard.
Right.
Well, they're building the factory in Israel. They can get skilled labor, you know, technical support, so on. Besides that, it's a military asset. It has very close military and intelligence links to the United States. I mean, it goes so far that the United States even prepositions weapons there, and Israel transfers some of its military industry to the United States, where they have better access to federal funds and markets and so on. It's kind of an offshore colony,
right.
A military high-tech colony. Now, you can argue that maybe that's a bad decision, but it's the decision that's been had an overwhelming effect on policy ever since 1967.
Absolutely. Well, gosh, unfortunately, we're out of time. This has been a fascinating conversation. I hope you'll be, I know you're very busy, but I hope in a little while we can get you back on.
Hope so.
Thank you so much.
Good
and
to talk
we'll
to you.
Talk
Have
to
good
you
trips.
Soon. Oh, thank you, Noam.
My name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you're listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.cindysheehansoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.cindysheehansoapbox.com.
Cindy Sheehan's new ebook, Myth America 2, further examines two distinct classes of people that clearly show that we are not all in this together, as President Obama has declared. The first group, the robber class, are wealthy victimizers such as those corporations and politicians that profit off the hard labor of others through economic theft and violent exploitation. The second group, the robbed class, are the victims such as those who work multiple jobs just to make ends meet, those who tragically send their children off to die in robber class wars, those who lack proper health care, those who are denied decent education, and those who lose jobs and homes due to robber class graft. The robber class controls our government, and as Cindy says, we, the robbed class, can only be robbed if we allow it. With pinpoint accuracy, humor, and in layperson's terms, Cindy Sheehan shows us why we should no longer be codependent with the robber class. To obtain a copy of Myth America 2, please visit CindySheehansSoapbox.com.
Come on, mothers throughout the land, pack your boys off to Vietnam. Come on, fathers, and don't hesitate. Send your sons off before it's too late. You can be the first ones in your block. Now have your boy come home in a box. And it's 1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7, open up pearly gates. Well, there ain't no time to wonder why. Whoopee, we're all gonna die.
Find the cost of freedom.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Instead of my rant today, we will have a listener rant from Lynn Jensen from Los Angeles, California.
Congressmember Jane Harman's wiretap scandal that broke earlier this year demonstrates the need for Democrats and others to actively work to change this country's leadership. It's more than shocking how this one self-proclaimed blue dog Democrat in Southern California betrayed her party, colluded with foreign agents, permitted George W. Bush to break the FISA law, and helped assure that this country was subjected to 8 miserable, lawless years of the Bush II administration, and that was before she allegedly interfered with a case against a suspected spy. As one of Congress's wealthiest and most powerful members, Harman represents the 36th Congressional District in Los Angeles County. For reasons still unclear, just before the 2004 presidential election, she joined with the Bush II White House to successfully pressure the New York Times to withhold the story about Bush's illegal wiretapping until after the election. Had the story run, the White House probably would have gone to Kerry and the Democrats. But the story didn't run, and the country kept a Republican and admitted felon as president, thanks in large part to Harman the Democrat. What Democrat does that to her own party? It cannot be explained as politics as usual. It's the exact opposite. Earlier this year, certain revelations provided a clue about why she did what she did when she was caught making a deal with an alleged Israeli spy on a legal, court-approved wiretap. The resulting scandal showed her to be deeply involved with both the Bush II Justice Department and an organization called the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, IPAC for short. 2 officials of that organization, Steve Rosen and Keith Weissman, pled guilty to spying before Harman was overheard discussing their case. In 2005, federal investigators wiretapped a 3rd suspected spy, and Harman just happened to be overheard talking to him. The suspect asked Harman to intervene on behalf of Rosen and Weissman, and she agreed to speak to Alberto Gonzalez. In return, the suspect told her he would not lobby Nancy Pelosi in line to become Speaker of the House to ensure that Harman become chair of the House Intelligence Committee once the Democrats won back the House in 2006. Harman went to Gonzalez. The combination of the wiretap and her meeting with him constitute evidence of an alleged federal crime on her part. He apparently did not agree to her request regarding the spies, but he quashed the federal investigation of her because, in his words, he needed her. How much he needed her for and for how long is still not clear, but one thing he definitely needed her for was to continue to defend the administration's repeated breaking of the FISA law, as she had in 2004 when she influenced the defeat of her own party's candidate. Neither has Pelosi come clean about what she knew about the Harman case or when. Israeli supporters did lobby Pelosi on Harman's behalf and did fundraising too, meaning that the Speaker of the House received money linked to several known or suspected foreign spies. She knew about the Harman investigation too. When the Democrats took control of the House in 2006, Pelosi did not appoint Harman as chair of the House Intelligence Committee, but around that time she said, "Impeachment is not on the table," enabling Bush to stay in office.
That was listener Lynn Jensen. And remember, you can send rants also. Send them to cindysoapbox@gmail.com.
Cindy Sheehan's new ebook, Myth America 2, further examines 2 distinct classes of people that clearly show that we are not all in this together, as President Obama has declared. The first group, the robber class, are wealthy victimizers such as those corporations and politicians that profit off the hard labor of others through economic theft and violent exploitation. The second group, the robbed class, are the victims such as those who work multiple jobs just to make ends meet, those who tragically send their children off to die in robber class wars, those who lack proper health care, those who are denied decent education, and those who lose jobs and homes due to robber class graft. The robber class controls our government, and as Cindy says, we, the robbed class, can only be robbed if we allow it. With pinpoint accuracy, humor, and in layperson's terms, Cindy Sheehan shows us why we should no longer be codependent with the robber class. To obtain a copy of Myth America 2, please visit CindySheehansSoapbox.com.
Hi, my name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you are listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.CindySheehansSoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.CindySheehansSoapbox.com.
Now you do what they told you. And 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 now you do what they told you. what you tell me. Fuck you, I won't do what you tell me. Fuck you, I won't do what you tell me. Fuck you, I won't do what you tell me. Fuck you, I won't do what you tell me. Fuck you, I won't do what you tell me. Fuck you, I won't do what you tell me. Fuck you, I won't do what you tell me. Fuck you, I won't do what you tell me. Fuck you, I won't do what you tell me. Fuck you, I won't do what you tell me. Fuck you, I won't do what you tell me. Fuck you, I won't do what you tell me. Fuck you, I won't do what you tell me. Motherfucker!
Our Ask Cindy question today isn't so much a question as a statement. Dear Cindy, first-time listener and loved your show. The Smedley Butler speech compilation was produced and directed by Butler Gordon and John R. Sexton, both of South Carolina, and should be credited as such. Keep up the great work, John R. Sexton. So, John and Butler, we just credited you.
My name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you are listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.cindysheehansoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.cindysheehansoapbox.com.
Cindy Sheehan's new ebook, Myth America 2, further examines two distinct classes of people that clearly show that we are not all in this together, as President Obama has declared. The first group, the robber class, are wealthy victimizers such as those corporations and politicians that profit off the hard labor of others through economic theft and violent exploitation. The second group, the robbed class, are the victims such as those who work multiple jobs just to make ends meet, those who tragically send their children off to die in robber class wars, those who lack proper health care, those who are denied decent education, and those who lose jobs and homes due to robber class graft. The robber class controls our government, and as Cindy says, we, the robbed class, can only be robbed if we allow it. With pinpoint accuracy, humor, and in layperson's terms, Cindy Sheehan shows us why we should no longer be codependent with the robber class. To obtain a copy of Myth America 2, please visit CindySheehansSoapbox.com.
Your soapbox assignment for the week is to spread the word about the soapbox again at CindySheehansSoapbox.com. Well, that's our great show for today. I'd like to thank our guest, Professor Noam Chomsky, Rational Radio, 1360 AM in Dallas, Texas, my engineer, Scott Cuddy, my webmaster, Rich Bowser, my assistant producer, Mikey, and you for listening. Next week, we are going to have another great show. We're going to have Malalai Joya. She's an Afghan parliamentarian and a feminist from Afghanistan. So please tune in.
Let's make my witness. To tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression.
Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. Dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. As if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
They're yelling in Baton Rouge.